Live, David.
Hey, it is welcome up to everybody to the Energy Realities Podcast. Here we are again. We don't have Tammy Nemeth with us, unfortunately. She's making an important speech up in Canada today. But Stu Turley is here. Irina Slav is here from Bulgaria. How's things in Europe today, Irina?
Well, in my part of Europe, it's a lovely March afternoon. Awesome. Very typical for the season, yeah.
Fantastic. Amazing. We're having a... Oh, gosh, the sun's out in Texas. Hey, we had rain for about a week over here. It's been awesome. Needed it on our grass. Anyway, here we go. We're talking about natural gas today. There's been a grand resurgence of demand for natural gas all over the world. Countries are trying to obtain as much of it as they can via LNG or new production to fuel their economies. And we're going to have a discussion about several stories that have broken recently on that topic. And Stu, here we go. UK heat pump makers look to government for certainty. Well, of course they do, because nobody wants their product. Whose story is this?
Irina's.
One of mine, I think. Well, these are both mine, actually.
Okay. Oh, there's two of them, right?
Yeah, Stu, if you want to just start the discussion, that's fine by me.
Oh, no. Let's hear from you this morning.
Well, basically what you said, David, is exactly right. People don't want to buy heat pumps. And there was another story also in the FT this week about heat pumps, that it appears that the UK government anticipated really major cost declines in heat pumps, which never materialized. I wonder why. Yeah, they expected something like 20 to 25% or 50% price decline, which never happened. And apparently there is very low awareness of heat pumps among the population. I mean, what is this supposed to mean? That people don't know that heat pumps exist, or that people don't know just how expensive they are, which is four times as much as a gas boiler? So, because their products are not selling as well as expected, the heat pump makers are basically asking the government to do something to make sure these heat pumps sell, which the only way I can think of this happening is by mandating heat pumps, which is what the UK government is doing, and which is what the European Union plans to do by banning all hydrocarbon sources of heating for homes from a certain year. And probably the heat pump makers want this to happen more quickly, like starting tomorrow. Can you imagine what this will cause if these mandates come into effect? Whenever. I mean, heat pump prices won't come down by much between now and 2030 or 2035. But they're looking
in the opposite direction. Yeah.
Irina, heat pumps don't work too good around zero Celsius.
I have heard from users that they actually can work at zero and sub-zero, but for them to work in an optimum fashion, they need to be installed in a new house that has all the necessary, insulation and the necessary system. But they could work in sub-zero temperatures. Just how sub-zero is another question.
I've got two, and they're not as good as propane or fireplace.
No.
I'll tell y'all a funny story. Over the weekend, a story broke. Was it the Wall Street Journal? I can't remember which publication I saw it in. The U.S. government has released a study last week in which it claims that adoption of heat pumps could result in cost savings for guess how what percentage of American homes? 100%.
Right.
Nothing is 100%, folks. That's the fakest of all fake claims ever made.
Wow.
These things are very noisy, very expensive, very inefficient in extreme temperature situations. They can work, but generally don't work.
Yeah, they don't work very well.
Right.
Unless you really have all the insulation in place and you're losing almost no heat, which is how common is that?
Not very.
Not very, yeah. And then there is this fixation on heat pumps. I really don't understand it, because we see two parallel narratives, basically. On the one hand, we need to degrow. We need to consume less energy. On the other hand, let's put in heat pumps, which consume a lot of energy to work.
Do you think, Irina, that it's about control from the standpoint if you have a new system and the government and the agencies could then lock down at a certain temperature what you get to live in?
Yeah, that would be smart meters. I think it's as much about control as it is about stupidity. I said it before. I mean, they are stupid and power hungry in equal measures to me.
I love you, Irina. You absolutely call it like you see it.
But it's just, there's too much evidence of both, especially the stupidity.
Yes.
Okay, and here we go. Europe gets lucky with a mild, windy winter. Europe gets lucky for the second winter in a row. Is this where we've come to? Getting lucky through the winter because it's warmer than usual? Well, somebody should have asked the Germans back in November when they had these snowstorms that were very seasonal and they weren't mild at all. How was energy consumption then? But sure, we got lucky. We have become dependent on the weather.
Yeah.
We're back to the Middle Ages or the Renaissance or whatever. We're back to pre-industrial times, counting ourselves lucky to have survived the winter without a gas shortage.
But isn't it global warming?
That's the really ironic part. If winters are getting generally warmer, which is not the case here. I mean, the winter before last was warmer than last winter in my part of Europe. Definitely. This one was colder. But I forgot. That was my train of thought. Yeah, if we're getting lucky, what are we doing? If we're depending on luck, if we're depending on the weather.
And how's it lucky if that's what everyone has predicted, right? Is that really getting lucky, or is it what's they predicted they ought to be taking credit for?
I don't know. Oh, yeah, I remembered what I was going to say. You have to thank climate change for having mild winters.
We have a great comment from Mahi. I'm sorry if I butchered your name.
Exactly. The ones that work best are the most expensive, which makes sense. Obviously.
Sure. Absolutely.
and we also had one from that. Sorry, we also had one from Nathan. Sorry, guys. Just want to give Nathan a shout out.
Good morning, Nathan.
We sit back and take a look. Do you remember, guys, when Germany was, I can't remember who it was. I believe it was a couple years ago when Germany was saying, you're not going to be able to have hot showers. It was somebody in the political office saying, we're going to cut everybody's energy sources and you're not going to be able to have
hot. They did that.
Yeah.
Yeah. They reduced the amount of heating sent through district heating systems to residential blocks.
Wow.
They did that to save gas. Yeah. And now they're planning to build more gas-powered plants.
Yes, exactly. And Germany is one of the most prominent movers in that direction. Of course, they've allocated, $17 billion in government subsidies to ensure they can all be equipped with the necessary technology to convert to hydrogen, right? When because that becomes viable, right? Yeah. Sure.
Yeah. Now, the hydrogen corridor and hydrogen, I think the last successful thing we had was the Hindenburg. Excuse me. But I really don't see hydrogen as being Irina, you and I last year talked about hydrogen. I didn't realize how much water was needed by hydrogen until you and I mean, really dug into some of the research on that.
Yeah, because nobody was talking about it and nobody still talks about it. I mean, we have the head of IRENA, the International Renewable Energy Agency, telling us that all sources of energy are intermittent, but wind and solar are the least intermittent because they depend on the sun and the wind.
Right.
I think we are past the point at which we could expect any common sense from the transition planners.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, they have to make up these fairy tales about it to make their preferred solutions make sense, right?
Yeah.
If it's only if nuclear and coal and natural gas somehow are defined to be intermittent that wind and solar can really make sense in a scaled up way. And so, I mean, it's all about the narrative with this stuff. And I'm frankly sick of it. To be honest,
yeah, me too.
It just would be so nice to be able to just have honest conversations about this stuff and make policy based on what actually happens in the real world and not based on some fantasy in which heat pumps are a better solution for 100% of American homes.
Hey, David, do you think this would be a good time to show this exclusive interview on CNN that we just got a cut over the weekend?
Oh, why not?
Okay. This is a great one. And I think that it is showing that there is some response back to the mainstream media coming up.
Talk about it. Everybody, talk about it. If we were talking about climate change the way we talk about a bunch of other very important issues, we'd be doing something about it. And then the thing to do about it really is to vote.
Hmm. You know, wait a minute, the Obamas talk about it, yet they spend $11 million on a beach house and they don't seem to be concerned about it raising sea levels. Celebrities and politicians, they preach the same message, but they buy multiple houses, cars, and private jets. They don't seem to be concerned. I mean, the banks, they give out 30 years mortgages on houses that, according to you, will be underwater before they get their money back. So can you make it make sense?
We can do this, people. Thank you.
We can do this.
Yeah, that's Bill Nye, the science guy, who spent the preponderance of his career doing 30-minute shows for children on NPR. He's an engineer. But he figured out about 10 years ago there's big money in being a climate alarmist. And so he does interviews like now for a living.
Wow. But he's an expert because he's the science guy.
Yes, but he's the science guy because I don't know why.
Wow. Nathan's got a good comment for us, David.
Stop making policies based on emotions. Wow, what a concept. Instead, start making policies based on facts and with people that have spent time with boots on the ground in the industry. Wouldn't that be a lovely thing?
Yeah, it's a real difference.
Yeah.
Until reality forces itself on the people who are making the emotion-based decisions. Mm-hmm. And they will wonder, where did we go wrong? Yes, they will.
There were several talks about, the UK. You had mentioned Germany doing that as well. And let me show you this right here. This is the slide as we go through this. There are 12,000 power plants that says oil and gas. However, there's 9,280 that are oil and gas. And if I went through and started looking at all of them and they just lump. They're mostly natural gas.
Virtually all of them are natural gas. Probably 80% of them.
It was high. And look at this. There's 576 under construction, under pre-construction. That's a lot of new power plants right in there. And then there's another 604 piled up on that. And these down in here canceled and shelved. So it's almost like there's a lot. And I'll come up with some other new numbers here on coal while we're talking. But I just want to share that there is a substantial new amount, and it's amazing how much of it is dependent on LNG.
Yeah, and that's the thing, and that's why there's such big concern among our customers, the U.S. LNG customers, about the Biden pause on permitting, because, you know, there's a big concern that the U.S. is not going to be a reliable trading partner on natural gas as demand continues to grow. All of these developing nations, not all of them, but many developing nations want more and more natural gas and power generation, in part to replace coal plants they're retiring due to pressures from the international community on emissions, and in part just because it's a lot more reliable and less expensive than trying to build an economy around intermittent, truly intermittent sources of energy like wind and solar. And so natural gas becomes the most viable option. It's a lot cheaper to build than nuclear. It takes a lot less time to get them up and running. And so it's a preferred solution. And the momentum behind that is actually growing in recent years, not declining, as the globalist community at the WEF and COP28 conference wants you to do. And that's just reality. It's the market functioning as we should expect the market to function. And governments concerned about their country's energy security, trying to ensure they have the resources needed to provide that energy security. Exactly. And that's my rant for today, I guess.
Yay! I think these are
still your Rishi Sunak story, okay? Let's go back okay. to that previous one, Rishi Sunak, okay? He's scrambling right now. His party is about 20% down in the polls in the UK because his party went so far to the left on climate alarmism and bought into everything that was being preached by COP and the WEF on this matter. And now his party is about to get thrown out of office and replaced with an even more radical party that's pretending not to be radical, called the British Labour Party, which is essentially a bunch of socialists. And so Sunak is now, you know, scrambling around trying to do some sensible things where energy is concerned. And one of those sensible things is what? To announce new gas power stations to ease the risk of blackouts, because the UK's grid is every bit as unreliable as California's and Germany's. And it's because of the policies of the British Tory Party, the Conservative Party, that has brought the grid in the UK to this sorry state. And so it's just a clear example of how politicians in some of these countries are trying to respond to this by saying, okay, we'll use more natural gas because natural gas has a cleaner reputation in the public domain than coal.
Right. And, you know, it's funny, what I find funny, they're talking about blackouts, but they're trying not to say why there will be blackouts. Yeah. And it's just, the truth is like leaking through the cracks that the blackouts will be because you need to balance your grid, and you can't balance your grid with wind and solar. They're basically trying to avoid saying it, but they're ending up saying it. This is really pathetic. And besides, if the Tories get voted out of office, which they probably will, what's going to happen to these gas power stations, the new ones? Nothing is going to happen because Labour will probably cancel them, unless they accidentally swallow a dose of reality and say, yeah, okay, let's have backup.
And the other story there, that other story about $30 billion, the government wants $30 billion for gas production, that's the one from Pakistan, I think, where they have discovered a resource of natural gas offshore, or actually, I think it's onshore, and they're wanting to be able to exploit it. Because why? Because they've been unable to obtain adequate amounts of LNG. And so they're trying to start up a significant domestic natural gas production industry, and of course that takes a lot of money. But they're trying to avoid going to coal, right? And I think so many of these developing nations, you know, are going to end up going to more coal because LNG, the uncertainties around U.S. LNG, and the ongoing rise in demand for it all over the world, in Europe and Asia in particular. All right, let's go to the next stories. Germany, $17 billion plan to subsidize gas to hydrogen shift. Okay, so, you know, they're going to spend $17 billion pursuing the pipe dream that you can just convert these natural gas plants to burn hydrogen without consideration of all the complexities that involves in delivery infrastructure. You can't just start putting hydrogen through a natural gas pipeline because the molecules
build the power plants themselves.
Right. And the molecules are so much. What is hydrogen? A hydrogen molecule is a tiny part of a natural gas molecule. Okay. To create hydrogen from natural gas, you have to break the molecules apart. So you end up with tiny, tiny molecules that are not going to be contained within a standard natural gas pipeline that will contain natural gas molecules. And so it's just, you're going to have to replace all of your transportation infrastructure that costs billions and billions of dollars. And this thought that you can just build these plants and retrofit them to burn hydrogen without creating, you know, all manner of hazards and problems is a pipe dream. It's just dumb. Same thing that's happening in California.
Yeah. You have to love California.
David, yeah, every bad energy idea that's possible is being tried in California.
I absolutely,
they're the guinea pigs of the transition.
Yes.
I absolutely loved your thing talking about, I believe it was the bullet train, another $100 billion. Is that correct?
Yeah, so the California bullet train, let's digress a little bit, okay? Because it is so funny. They had hearings last week about the status of the California's plan to build a bullet train between Los Angeles and San Francisco. And this was first proposed in 1996, okay, 28 years ago, with an initial estimated cost of $10 billion. And then time goes on and, you know, it stops and starts and fits. And so finally, the voters get to vote on it in 2008 on a ballot initiative and end up approving it stupidly with an estimated price tag at that point of $29 billion. So it had grown by 200% in just 12 years. And so now we're 16 years later. They still haven't gotten the environmental permitting fully done for this 494-mile rail route, okay? They've gotten approvals for 412, I think, or 422 miles of the 494-mile route for environmental approvals. And the agency was boasting about that, just thrilled to death that they're finally about 85% complete in the environmental permitting over just a span of 16 years. They still have 72 miles of permitting to go. And they asked the legislature, they told the legislature that, well, you know, it's already costing us about $100 billion now, and we're going to need another $100 billion to get it all done. So you're going to end up, if you ever get it done, which I frankly don't believe it'll ever get completely built, a $200 billion. Now you're $200 billion 28 years after you first told the legislature it was going to cost 10. So that's a, what, 2,000% inflation in the price tag. And
that's,
you know,
a lot of money.
It's a lot of money for a fast train when you can get on a plane that actually flies at 400 miles an hour compared to the 200 mile an hour train you want to build and get to San Francisco from Los Angeles twice as fast today. You can do that today.
Yeah, but you get emissions. I expect the train would run on electricity. Well, where would this electricity come from? Solar panels?
Well, I mean, California's grid currently is about 50% natural gas. So there are a few emissions.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and then they got wind and solar and
feather.
Anyway, so that's the... That's
right now, the air is being sucked out of the room funding-wise by this one project. How do we get the public on board
this,
with
David,
that
is
has
a,
this
a,
much
a,
of a downside
a secret
to it,
video I got.
Funding wise.
I think the only way you get the public is by performing better. And I think the authority is performing better today than it was. And I think it will going forward. I think it's the right thing to do for the future of the state and the country. And yes, it's a challenge. And just like when I worked on the Bay Bridge years ago, and you're stuck in the middle of a very tough project, it feels impossible until it's not. And then you just grind, you do the work, you perform better, you deliver.
You know why it feels impossible to those members of the legislature? Because they're currently trying to close a $73 billion budget deficit for this fiscal year alone.
Whoa.
That's the same guy that did the bridge that was over budget, under delivered, and terrible. Right. But right. It's not done until it's done. So, anyway, so I thought it was.
You hired the exact same guy to try to finish this project. It's incredible.
Anyway, I'm sorry. I thought that was a really good timing on that one as well. We got another comment from Mahay.
Trains can scale better than aviation, not in America.
Not green bullet trains. But that was a great comment. Okay, David, we're back. Was it India?
See, India wants more gas too, and they're going to spend $67 billion to modernize their natural gas delivery systems, which, you know, are kind of old and antiquated and inadequate. And why are they doing that? Because they're planning to build a lot more natural gas power plants in the future, as well as more coal plants. By the way, they've got Chinese companies in India right now building, I can't remember how many new coal-fired power plants too. So India is, while I guess, you know, they go to the WEF and COP conferences and talk a good game, India is on the same path as China, going to fossil fuels.
Yeah, they've learned a lesson from them. All of the above is the right approach.
And yeah. David, we've got another comment on this.
Well, they've shut down all but one.
Diablo Canyon. Yeah. And they just got an extension. And they just got an extension on it. Mm-hmm. And it, I believe, it offers 9% to 10% of the power in California, and they'd be dead meat without it. Great comment.
That's why they extended its permit. Yeah.
Here, once the rails are laid in.
Yeah.
The
problem is getting the rails laid. Because the permitting is so difficult. As we see with this one, I mean, this is one 494-mile line, and we're 28 years down the road already. One line.
But that's because of the environmental assessment review. Right. Where apparently, they're going around for each mile of the route, examining it for, I don't know, rare species. Yeah. But I wanted to say about electric bullet trains in Europe. From my limited experience, they're not cheap. They're very convenient. They're very fast where possible, because you can do maximum speed across your route. But they are not cheap. They may be green. They are green because they're on electric. But cheap, they're not.
Now, Irina, they're only green if you're running nuclear or renewables, which are not relying. Is that a fair statement?
That's a very fair statement. Thank you for making it, Stuart. That's true.
Just thought I'd ask.
Yeah.
Let's see here. Here's Tammy's, but let's have a moment of silence in preparation for Tammy's presentation in Canada. Okay, thank you. It'll be a great one. Here's another couple here. Net zero climate goal. Guys, David and Irene, I want to ask your opinion. I'm seeing a ton of net zero goals not being made. Corporate America and a ton of people are backing off. And now they're sliding it back out. And this article was quite amazing when it started talking about like the EV cars and everybody else. Nobody can make any of these horrific goals.
Of course they can, because they're impossible. Yeah. But it took a lot of people a lot of time to realize this. It seems they all bought the wishful thinking, they all bought the EV revolution propaganda, and they had to see with their own eyes that it is not working and start admitting that it's not working, because there is no way it could work. They did try everything, including mandates.
You know, and when we sit back and take a look at Biden's budget, holy smokes, Batman. I believe it's $7.2 trillion, $5.3 trillion, what's a few trillion between friends, and then 1.7 trillion or whatever the number is in tax increases. I'm like, this is just unsustainable when you sit back and take a look at it. And in this, there's 40,000 new climate activists for Gen Z that they have in this budget. And it's just like, do you know what we could do with $50 billion to help our homeless, to help our great veterans, to help, you know, put power plants in Africa, but yet we're going to put it on climate activism? I don't get it.
Yes. Yeah. And that, so that, I mean, the fact that the timelines are sliding is entirely predictable. And,
yeah,
you know, anybody with any knowledge of how the markets work and the challenges and just in trying to obtain the mineral needs alone, knew these timelines would have to slide. And they're going to slide a lot more than 2060. I mean, probably going to slide 100 years before all is said and done, and maybe longer than that, because you can't do you can't convert a $300 trillion energy system, global energy system, in 25 years, which is, you know, what these ridiculous timelines that have been set contemplate. No energy transition in history has ever taken place in that kind of a time frame, and this one won't either. And as Dan Yergin has told me repeatedly, the previous transitions have taken at least 100 years, and you don't end up with 100% transition at the end. Yeah. We're burning more wood now for energy, which was supposedly replaced by coal 500 years ago. We're burning more wood now for electricity than we did 500 or than we ever have. And same with coal. Coal demand set new records last year. It'll set another new record this year, and on and on and on, you know. So we're going to need fossil fuels, that, you know, what we call fossil fuels, for a long time to come.
This one, this map is the power plants associated with solar and wind. I think it's 65,000. You can see the green everywhere on this. This one was oil and gas, which we know is 12,000. But we take a look at this one, I believe, is nuclear. There's only 1,450. And then this one is coal. Look at the coal in India and China
and Europe.
And I'm getting numbers together. So when you take a look at coal, nuclear, and then you take a look at the number here, let's put the megawatt actually on the grids versus what is paid for, and then actually compare that to maintenance dollars, and you're going to have some serious number crunching that is not adding up. So I hope that helps.
Yeah, very informative.
Yes, none of it adds up.
No, it doesn't.
I had an interview with the CEO of Wood PLC, the big energy service company based in England, and this was Friday when I interviewed him, and it'll be published later this week. He was very adamant about the timeline question, you know, that's the biggest challenge. And like so many of the real leaders in these energy industries, he specifically talked about minerals, mining, and acquisition as the single biggest challenge that's going to cause these timelines to extend. So, I mean, that was a very timely article, because it's what the thinking, you're going to see it. I suspect this week's CERAWeek is convening today as we're recording this. Yeah. And I suspect that's going to be a pretty dominant topic among others at the CERAWeek conference this year, because it's becoming more and more obvious to everyone that's the biggest mountain you have to overcome to get where these folks want to go.
And there's something else. All transitions until now have happened more rather than less organically.
Yes.
A better fuel comes along, so you switch it because it's better. And the more of it you produce, the cheaper it becomes, and the more people can use it. This is not the case with this transition. Many commentators have pointed this out. This is the first energy transition that is happening under duress, basically.
Yeah.
Most of us.
And it's an attempt to force markets to behave in ways markets would not naturally behave, and that's always a false error.
And they're trying to force markets and human behavior on which markets are based. And it has no way of working without mandates. But mandates could only work up to a limited extent, because then the backlash would begin, and so on and so forth.
Another big concern he expressed in that interview, and I think it's really a good one, and I think everyone needs to think about it, is when you try to subsidize, you know, force a subsidized transition, which is what we're doing in the Western world, and really in China and India as well, you run a big risk of, you know, we have these three chosen solutions, wind, solar, and electric vehicles, that have been chosen by the globalists at the WEF and the UN and all these global conferences as the solutions. Well, you run the big risk of choosing the wrong technology, right? What if these technologies aren't the real solutions, which I think is becoming increasingly obvious that they are.
Yeah, they're not.
Well, then you've wasted trillions and trillions of dollars pursuing solutions that won't work, that you can't really scale up to meaningful levels. And I think that, to me, is the biggest risk we face, is we're going to bankrupt our national economies pursuing solutions that really can't solve the problem.
Yeah, the deindustrialization of Germany, of Europe, and the U.S. is underway. And I find it hypocritical that the EIA 2 years ago said that natural gas was one of the biggest reasons we dropped 20% of our net carbon net output, or our carbon output. But yet they're not allowing for any new natural gas plants up in the Northeast. It's kind of hypocritical.
Well, the problem, of course, in the Northeast, their big problem is they can't get natural gas other than to import it from other countries, because New York State won't let anyone build a pipeline to New England from the Marcellus Shale. And you have this perfect storm of stupidity happening up there that prevents them from pursuing a real solution.
Perfect storm of stupidity. That sounds like a new book.
Absolutely. I think I might have to write a column with that title on it, actually.
It's a great way of putting it. Yeah. It is a perfect storm of stupidity and incompetence.
And incompetence.
Oh, how fun. I'll tell you, what's coming around the corner next week, do you see, Irina?
In what sense? I expect more stupid news and more idiotic statements from transition, leaders. No, I've come to expect everything, and nobody's challenging them openly when they make these statements. This is what kills me.
Yeah.
Really? Are we so afraid to challenge fantasy that is being presented as fact? So expect more of this from Zero Week.
Yeah. I think you're right. I think you're right.
It's from Big Oil.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree with Irina. I mean, Jennifer Granholm is speaking at CERAWeek, so we'll get a lot of exactly what Irina is expecting from her speech. And but for me personally, I'm really looking forward to some more interviews. I've got a couple more set up during CERAWeek, and then next week I've got interviews with Chris Wright at Liberty Energy, which is, you know, he's always fun to talk to. And Michelle Manouk, who is the CEO of the Global Coal Trade Association, and incredibly smart, great spokesperson for the coal industry, to talk about where she thinks coal's future is headed. And you have to admit, with the way demand continues to increase for coal, the coal industry has a bright future ahead of it.
Yeah.
And we ought to be spending some of these subsidy dollars to find ways to take more of the emissions out of coal, so we can continue to exploit, you know, truly the biggest energy resource we have available to us globally.
And reliable.
That would be the smart thing. And reliable 24/7 power generation. Yes.
You know, David, I can't wait to hear your Chris Wright. I was fortunate enough to have Chris Wright and Doomberg, and I'm releasing that one on Wednesday. And we talked about in ending energy poverty. Chris Wright has a wonderful new report out that I believe you. I mean, he is such a cool cat. Yeah. Chris has really shaped how I've done my podcast over all these years. It's about ending energy poverty. And I guarantee you, you're going to have a fantastic discussion with him.
Yes. Oh, yeah. I mean, and I've interviewed him before. I wrote a cover story for a magazine about him several years ago. He's fantastic.
And Peter brings up the great point. It's not just the minerals. It's the process, energy, human costs for mining low-grade ores. Chris Wright, zero poverty by 2050 is much more measurable. Peter, great
point. Much more pressing. The energy poverty problem is much more pressing than whatever the net zero fanatics are telling us is important.
And it's an actual problem. In my interview with NJ and the head of the African Energy Chamber, I absolutely loved from the standpoint that he's standing up for Africa first to end energy poverty. Right. And I'm going to just talk about capitalism here for a second. We could make more money as the U.S. if we exported our technology, our nuclear technology, our natural gas technology, and built up markets in Africa and make big high paying jobs in Africa and then sell things over there to them. The world could grow economically if we end energy poverty. Sorry for getting on my rant this morning.
Yeah, but economic growth is no longer trendy. We're talking about degrowth because we don't need it. I'm writing a Substack about this for Wednesday.
Oh, I can't wait to read it.
Yeah, write it.
And Irina, I want to give you a shout out again. I've said this before, but I get my Irina Slav fix every time I listen to one of your Substacks, because you read the Substack. And for all of our followers today, it's irinaslav.substack.com. And listen to Irina as she reads these, because it is a real treat. You understand her sense of humor. I don't know.
Don't hype me.
Sorry. It's too bad.
No, but it's absolutely true. The audio recordings you do with your stories really enhances that whole experience, because you know sometimes reading you're so witty. Sometimes just reading it, you miss some of it. But if you listen to the audio as well, you get the full. Okay. Impact of the stories, they're always hilarious.
And Irina, if I read it, my combination of oaky text, nobody would understand it. But you really, your humor brings out.
Thank you. You're very nice, both of you. Thanks.
All right. Hey, next week, we've got a great show lined up. What's the name? Curmudgeon? What's the name of it?
I have no idea what you're talking about.
All the email trails coming back and forth was what we're going to talk about next week with curmudgeon, something.
Oh, Klimageld.
Thank you.
Climate money. Yeah.
Okay.
The new carbon tax rebates in Germany. So we're going to talk about carbon taxes in general and this wonderful idea that the Germans had yet again on how to entice people to be more open to the changes in lifestyle related to the energy transition.
So how do you
great? And Tammy is going to be here.
And Tammy's going to be here. And how do you pronounce that again?
Klimageld.
Klimagen. I'm over here going, okay.
Climate money. Yeah.
Okay, got it. I think that's fantastic. And so we'll get Tammy back, and we've got several other executives that we're lining up as well to be a guest on here. We need to work on Irina's Oki and Texas line. Y'all would be a great start. Nathan, way to go, Nathan. All right.
Hey, y'all, we're fixing to go.
Okay. I love Southern dialects.
All right.
Okay, have a great day. Have a great week.
All right, y'all. We're fixing y'all to get out of here.
I'm going to go with my y'all.
Yeehaw.
Thank you to everybody that was listening live and to all those that are listening on our podcast channel, Energy Realities on wherever you can get your fix. And we got one more here.
Inconvenient Doubts by Joanne Marcotti. A book. Okay. Good. I'm going to go find it right now.
Great recommendation. Thank you.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye, y'all.
Bye. Have a great day.